This plenary session aims to tie together the amazing regional biodiversity surrounding us here in Chattanooga with the bigger global picture and how this biodiversity and ecosystem services that it provides fuels sustainable cities, where better to talk to people about the juxtaposition of all of these things than in Chattanooga. To moderate this session, we have M. Sanjayan, a guy who's difficult to label because he's both scientist and conservation advocate, TV correspondent, and he's in the process of making two major environmental documentaries, one for PBS and one for Showtime. He and the panelists today have all given this topic serious thought and serious effort, and we're delighted to have them here to share these thoughts with us. Sanjayan.
Great. Thank you. We could have continued to raise money, but you guys had to stop for us. After hearing us, you might want the money back. So it's a little bit abbreviated today, and so I'll make these introductions really fast because I want to get into discussion with our two panelists and also then open this up to a dialogue with all of you who, frankly, will have great questions, I know, for both of them and perhaps for myself as well. So starting over there is, as most of you probably know, Dr. Stuart Pym. He's the Doris Duke Professor of Conservation Ecology at the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. He really is a leader in conservation biology and conservation ecology, particularly around the study of extinctions and hotspots and sort of the diversity of life on Earth, and really travels to places like Ecuador and to Africa and to other regions, Florida, where diversity really is apparent even to the lay eye. Over 250 scientific publications. I'm sure if he'll write something up about this. He's been working with Big Cats Initiative with National Geographic. He won the Tyler Prize for the Environment in 2010, and Society for Conservation Biology gave him the Edward T. Laroe Memorial Award in 2006. Moving on, all of you know Anna George, who had to step in here a couple of times over the course of the last few days and was patiently answering questions about, is that a sturgeon, is that a paddlefish, is that a shark, where are the belugas, over and over again yesterday. And I did stop by yesterday at the aquarium and chatted with her a little bit. She's the director of the Chattanooga, Tennessee Aquarium Conservation Institute and the chief research scientist for the institute as well. She has been called an environmental hero by the president of Audubon Society, completely passionate about freshwater species and freshwater fish, both locally here and around the world, and a great spokesperson for the diversity of aquatic life, and also engaged with environmental education. Over 100,000 kids a year basically come through the aquarium and through the programs that she runs with the help of Toyota and other sponsors, I believe. Okay, so starting right into this, let me start with you, Stuart. And we'll keep these answers as short as we can. Allow me to interrupt occasionally just to kind of move this conversation on, and given the abbreviated time we have. Can you define for us biodiversity? When we talk about biodiversity, what do we mean by that?
I looked up biodiversity on the web the other day, and it had more hits than did Madonna. Now, you might wonder why I typed in Madonna. It's because I'm sort of challenged about modern culture, but I'd heard of her. I have three friends who claim to have invented biodiversity. Tom Lovejoy used the term first. Ed Wilson made the term famous. But Elliot North of the Marine Conservation Biology Initiative defined it. And the nerdy definition is genes, species, and ecosystems. But let me unpack them. If you look at what the Nature Conservancy does, it predominantly defines nature as space around people predominantly in the northeastern United States. It's green spaces. It's places that are green and lush near where we live. And that, by the very definition of TNC's success, is clearly an important definition. Ecosystems in that sense of the simply the natural environment around us is one component. And the diversity of different ecosystems, of diversity of deserts and grasslands and forests, is part of that definition. A major piece of the definition is species. And there is no better place than the Tennessee Aquarium, because you can go in there and you can just celebrate the diversity of all those different kinds of fish. And people do celebrate diversity. They celebrate the diversity of fish and amphibians and birds and plants. We all love the variety of different plants that we have in our gardens. There's also the diversity of genes, the diversity within a species. And that's economically important. But you know, the most important aspect, I think, to that diversity is our own. We are extraordinarily diverse as a species. We have 6,500 different languages that we speak. Those languages are becoming extinct even faster than species. 2 generations from now, we humans will only speak 600 languages. So we should also recognize that our diversity is important, and the diversity within a species is important too. It's all of that. It's all creatures, great and small, all that.
Great. So why does it matter?
Sure, I get the easy question.
Sounds fantastic.
You know, one of the great things about the human diversity is that there's as many different questions or answers to that question, and they reach different humans for different reasons. I like to break down why biodiversity matters to 2 basic concepts. One is the intrinsic value of biodiversity. It has value. It matters simply because it is there. It exists. It is a product of millions upon millions of years of evolution. So biodiversity matters simply because it's here. The other is the more human-centric way to define why it matters, and that's a utilitarian purpose of diversity. Sometimes that utilitarian purpose is for us humans. Maybe we're going to find a new medicine from a new species. Maybe we're going to find something we can replicate from it. So shark skin being used to create swimsuits that allow athletes to swim faster because we're modeling it after the diversity, the information that's there in the wild. We need it for food, for shelter, for clean water, all these ecosystem services that are provided to us. So that's one way that it matters.
But let me push you on that. So we take this big assumption that diversity of life in its all its glory, as Stuart beautifully laid out to us, is really important to our lives. But do we need it all? I mean, you go through the Tennessee Aquarium and you're stunned at how many different species of fish there might be, or amphibians, or the turtle exhibit. You know, that was amazing. I love turtles. It was a great place to linger. But do we need all of it? Are we making a giant leap when we assume, and no one really asks, whether they are all needed?
And this is something I think you still see the scientific field working on. Unfortunately, in many cases, we only know the answer to that when something is gone. So as conservation biologists, we're working with this assumption that it does all matter, and we don't know until we've lost something, perhaps, what its real importance in the environment was.
So let me just ask that, but in a slightly different way. Have there been papers written in the scientific literature that say, this species went extinct and it didn't really matter? No one noticed, and the forest is just fine, and everyone else is happy, except this thing is now gone.
You know, I want to...
There might be a paper like that. I mean, I'm serious. I'm not joking about it.
But I want to back up a little bit, because there's a word that we always want to skirt around. It's God. You know, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Now, in the original, it's not world, it's cosmos. Now, What strikes me is that we scientists are really, really nervous about bringing in the fact that there is an extraordinary ethical, religious compunction to look after what we have. And it might have been in the first of your definitions. But let's face it, there are ethical, religious, spiritual reasons for being good stewards, so that we pass the planet that we have onto subsequent generations. Yeah. I mean, we can call it intergenerational equity and use all sorts of technical terms that social scientists use, and I ate one. But you know what? There really is an issue there that we cannot escape. Now, but to come to your point about, you know, species don't go extinct just like that. And the classic case of that was the snail darter here in Tennessee, discovered by my good friend and long-term colleague David Ettenmeyer. Long before David went out with a six-pack of beer and discovered the snail darter.
It wasn't just six.
Well, I know that, but I love David, and I'm trying to restore his reputation. It was cheap beer, because I did ask him about that, and he never drank anything better. Be that as it may, people cared about the Little Tennessee River because it was a river, it was burial grounds of Native Americans, it was a great place to fish. And yet that's always held up as this sort of little fish versus technological progress. It's never like that. There's never a species that simply goes. It's always part of some larger battle. If we'd have lost the northern spotted owl, we would have lost the Pacific old-growth forests, 300 other species, an amazing part of our planet.
So it's a bit of a false dichotomy to pit this one critter against something else and then ask that one thing to hold up a value equivalent or greater than whatever is replacing it.
Absolutely. The snail darter was about a river. It was about having rivers in the southern Appalachians. It was not about an obscure little fish, beautiful though it is.
Okay, so coming back to your first point about the moral, ethical sort of dilemma that we face. Certainly when I started down the path to being a conservation biologist, that was the big motivation. Michael Sule, my advisor, had written a book at that time called Conservation Biology. He used that word in the title, and he put Science of Scarcity and Diversity on the cover. There it was, diversity, scarcity, and the emblematic animal he put on the cover was a rhino, black rhino. Is that enough, trying to get people to accept the diversity of life as something that society ought to maintain at some cost? Is it enough to think of it from just a religious, moral, ethical dilemma? So let me start with you, and I would love to hear both.
My opinion is that we have to have a variety of approaches to convince society for various aspects of conservation. I think in some parts of this world, this what I refer to as the Spider-Man approach is very good. With great power comes great responsibility. We as humans are the only species that is capable of making a choice in our actions. We're capable of choosing whether we're going to build a dam or whether we're going to leave a river undammed. We're capable of choosing whether we're going to go to solar power or build a nuclear power plant or coal or use less energy. So we have these powers available to us. We have to use them responsibly. We are the only species that can be a good steward of the earth, and thus that is our obligation too. That's a moral view, again, as Stuart was mentioning. Sometimes we try to use this with a religious aspect to it, but I think this is something that's capable for anyone, is what is our moral obligation as humans to protect?
But have you seen that, and I'll come to you, Stuart, on the same question, but just have you seen that shift through time about how it's being reported? So, certainly my impression is that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, more stories were there about sort of the wonder of diversity and discovery. And today, the preponderance of stories are about storms and floods and, you know, so moving into the service-oriented. If nature isn't useful to me, then why should I care? argument.
We certainly see that. We see a shift in the number of people who even know what the term biodiversity means. It's getting lost in the conservation discussion at the moment, more towards how do we protect a functioning ecosystem. And I think that's a huge shame. We've discussed at the aquarium whether we should use the term wildlife instead. Is this something that resonates more with popular culture today than the word biodiversity?
Well, what you said is a terrible shame, but again, I'm going to ask you, why is it a shame? If more people are resonating to a message, you can raise more money, you can raise more funds, you can motivate more people to action, why is it a shame?
I think it's a shame for us to lose this incredible wonder of life that we have out there. Not just species diversity, genetic diversity, ecosystem diversity. I feel like every time we take our attention away from that, we're settling for something that's a little bit less value. If you gave an elementary school student an 8-pack of crayons versus a 64-pack, which one do you think they would choose? They go for the 64-pack. They go for more color. They go for more options. And when we take our attention away from biodiversity, we're losing our options for the future.
I don't want to think for a minute that we shouldn't make the economic arguments. And I make them all of the time with approach that goes for the jugular. You know, the economic argument against Tellico Dam was enormously compelling. It was a total piece of pork barrel legislation. The economists had to come up with a totally fabricated argument that it was going to lead to a community of 60,000 people developing on the shores of the lake because of the cheap electricity that was going to be generated. Well, guys, you know, I've been there recently and somehow I missed the city of 60,000 people. So I'm quite prepared to arm wrestle anybody on the economics. So it's not that I don't think we shouldn't be making those arguments. We should. Biodiversity has a value. Ecosystem services has an enormous value. But don't let's get away from the fundamental ethical responsibility that we have. It's not something we can shunt under the carpet. And I really worry about this tendency for big organizations to shape their messages on the basis of polls that they have done about what people think. TNC has just done one. You know, we mustn't use this term. We can use that term. You know, mustn't talk about climate change because it's controversial. I'm a professor. I have an ethical responsibility to tell people what the facts are, not to be beaten up, moved, swayed by what the fads and the whims and the fashions are.
But aren't you then making, so you're okay, you painted a very powerful picture about how it wasn't really about the snail darter versus the dam, that it was a way of life, it was a river, it was a community, and they're the ones who rose up to do it. Yet for most people who even know the story, it is about a fish versus a dam. So by focusing our efforts and telling our story through a species or through a collection of species, don't we undermine the message itself?
There's a reason that I think this is my sixth SEJ conference. I love you guys. I know you're enormously important for me to get my scientific message out. Thank you so much for being here. And you know what? We scientists have got to do a better job of clarifying our science, but we have to work with the media to make sure that we get the right message.
Okay. So if we are to accept that the diversity of life, there is a moral ethical response, which we won't go into here in depth, but let's assume that there is. Is that ethical duty found throughout society, or is it does it typically rest with affluent, white, mostly urban, mostly liberal individuals? And I mean, you know, we were laughing about this because
Well, working in the Southeast, we don't have the population you describe. So we do have somewhat of an urban-rural divide, which we're seeing growing in this country right now. And the question is, how do we bring those different populations together to a common understanding? We choose our conservation projects at the Tennessee Aquarium with a number of purposes in mind. One of them, of course, is endangered animals that could use help. Another is what is going to tell a story that people will learn something from. So for that reason, we tend to work with fish that might be considered game species, but for whatever reason are not actually healthy enough to serve that utilitarian purpose. So I know several of you last night got the chance to pet one of our lake sturgeon in the touch tank. Great example. One of the most charismatic fish we have in southeastern rivers. They were completely lost from Tennessee by the 1970s due to a combination of factors, poor agricultural practices, damming of our rivers, water quality issues, and over-harvest of the species as well. This is also one, though, that now you can go out and catch a lake sturgeon in Tennessee again. It is a catch-and-release fishery. It is not for take. But that's still enough to expose someone to a fish that they never had a chance to encounter in the past 20 years in Tennessee. Yeah. So we're choosing to work with species that can tell a story of the value of diversity to humans that also have an intrinsic right to be in our rivers simply because they have been there.
And when you say humans, you mean the entire spectrum of society who could vote or who could support?
The entire spectrum of society.
I mean, the reason I say this is because, you know, if you go to, say, Alum Rock Park, State Park in California, it's right on the edge of San Jose, and you walk through there, you'll see two different kinds of use of that park. It's pretty obvious to anyone who goes through there. In the lowlands, right by the parking lot, in sort of the open grassy areas, maybe by the creek, you will find Asian families and Latino families. And there will be the whole family there, the mothers, the fathers, the grandfathers, the uncles, the aunts, the babies. They'll be loud, they'll have music, they'll have food. As an Asian, as I walk past them, I sort of get slightly embarrassed, you know, that the whole Asian family is now decamped there, and sometimes they look at me as if they should know me. And I know they're thinking Sanjay Gupta from CNN. And then you go up in the hills. And once you get up in the hills, you find very few people. But they will typically be young, white. They'll be wearing Patagonia gear. They'll look a little angry. They'll look determined to reach some top or some peak. And when Stuart sort of says, look, you shouldn't think about the whims of, you know, the fads of society. As a scientist, I couldn't agree more. But if you want a ballot initiative to pass in California, you have to run it with the taglines, our land, our water, our way of life. You cannot run it with the California condor, the kit fox, and the Coachella Valley fringe toad lizard. It will fail because you will never get the Latino vote, the Hispanic vote, which is incredibly important, and the crucial shift there for those initiatives. That's why over and over again, in red states and blue states, the Nature Conservancy backs ballot initiatives that tend to work. Fad versus being smart about communicating to audiences. What's the difference?
So I want to back up a bit. So you've talked about what these people were wearing. They're wearing Patagonia clothes. Good. I'm in a canoe. I'm the only person wearing clothes at all. Everybody else is essentially naked. Right? In the bottom of the canoe are some 6-foot-long spears. And they're not for decoration. They're there because the Huarani defend a larger area of Ecuador than any other tribe because they run those spears through people who annoy them. And there's three generations. There's an enormous number of people in this canoe. The grandparents are people who made first contact. Then they know an amazing amount, I mean, an extraordinary amount about the forest because they lived in it. They grew up in it. It's their home. They were not settled people. They were hunter-gatherers. Their children were taught in Spanish schools, Spanish-speaking schools, and know squat about their own culture and their biodiversity. And their grandchildren are learning about that biodiversity from their grandparents, with aid from three of my students, who spend months at a time living in these traditional villages with people who sometimes wear clothes and usually don't. I have three amazing Amazon explorers, and they are all women, because I think men don't have the right stuff. Now, what my students are doing, who all speak Wa, is developing programs so that the grandparents will teach the grandchildren about their biodiversity. So yes, I see your yuppie divide in California. But when you started this conversation, you were saying, you know, maybe only us rich white liberals care about biodiversity. It's simply not true. The communities I work with in Ecuador, in Colombia, in Madagascar, in Africa, live in a world lit only by fire, and they depend on biodiversity in a way that's much more immediate and much more important than we do.
I would also, we're bouncing around.
No,
so I'm going to come back.
That's a great answer. It's a global perspective, which is useful, and it really goes to the heart. You know, is this a language that is only useful for one small segment of society that many of us are more comfortable with, or is it a universal understanding and that can translate into other cultures and communities? So what's your experience?
What I will say from my experience is that protecting biodiversity requires diversity. And so for your fad versus fact question, we require the facts from the professors. We require the conservation organizations to translate those for the public. We require the educational institutions like the Tennessee Aquarium to explain and explore diversity with the public. But we all have to be working together, including the journalists who are helping tell these stories as well. So to me, that's another false dichotomy. It's not fad versus fact. It's fad and fact. It is what grabs someone's attention and what is solid understanding behind that attention. So it's making sure that we're all at this table. And that includes whether we're wearing Patagonia clothes or we're wearing our Carhartt overalls because we just went duck hunting. These are not dichotomies. These are all of us in our society as a diverse society in the United States. The conservation field started with a very liberal, white, academic background. And as we see the United States demographic shift, we see the conservation field shift. Mm-hmm. Some organizations are very ahead on this, like Audubon, I know, has done a lot of work with their diversity initiatives, making sure they're bringing new voices to the table. And as you look at the polling for some of these minority communities in the United States, they do not need an explanation on why biodiversity matters. When you are out fishing for your food.
Right, but that's interesting you said that. I'm going to stop. Most polls that are done in the U.S. show that minority groups tend to value nature, put a value on nature more so than white groups. But the way they understand it is a little different. It's about what it does for them. It's a place for kids to play. It's air that they
breathe.
It's fishing. You know, it's not necessarily in the same way as certainly my training, which would make me immediately go to the coolest animal that lives there and sort of want to try to protect it.
Sure, but I think this is also an environmental justice issue we're starting to get into. If you are a minority community which has been disproportionately affected by pollution, of course you're going to have a different value on the environment and want to protect it for different reasons.
So in terms of biodiversity, you know, you talked about the Huarani in Ecuador. So one of the things that's going on with the Huarani right now, so they are in a giant chunk of the Ecuadorian Amazon, on the sort of the eastern part of Ecuador. And there's a zone in there called the intangible zone, which is basically the Ecuadorian government sort of saying kind of hands off much of this area because there are first contact people still in this area. But right on the edges of it, in fact, right in it, is, as you know, a lot of oil that the Ecuadorian government wants to drill. So what the president of Ecuador said was, okay, world community, you guys are always going on about biodiversity. Fine, we will leave this oil in the ground if the world puts up several billion dollars. I forgot the exact number, but five, something like that, billion dollars. And initially there was a raft of journalists and celebrities who went down there and made all these pledges, but very little of it came to be. Almost none of it was raised. If you go to the airport in Quito, you can buy chocolate that will support Yasuni National Park. And the minute I saw that, I thought, if they're going to sell chocolate in order to raise money, like billions of dollars, it ain't going to happen. So what's the price that we can put on biodiversity? I mean, wasn't that a very smart move by Ecuadorian government to say to the world community, put up or shut up?
This is a hugely complicated issue. I mentioned being in a canoe with Warani and they having spears. The reason that they had the spears is because we spent about 8 hours traveling across territory that we thought might be occupied by Tarangire, which is one of the uncontacted groups. And making contact with an uncontacted group is usually extremely unpleasant in the sense that either you spear somebody or they spear you first. So there are, you know, some serious issues with uncontacted peoples there. But what I find in this entire debate is that it's been couched in terms of Highland Ecuadorians who are saying, we have to have this oil for our future. And you rich, white, liberal, you know, Democrat voting Westerners have to pay to keep us out of there. And what's missing in that is that that land is not vacant. It is full of the Warani, and it's full of the Tangiri and Teremanani, who are the two uncontacted groups. This is fundamentally a human rights issue. And this is an issue where a small number of people in Ecuador, rich people in Ecuador who want to make a lot of money, want to go in and commit genocide, admittedly to small numbers of tribes, but nonetheless want to go in there and eliminate those people from their land in much the same way that we Americans eliminated Native American peoples across most of our country. This is fundamentally a human rights issue. And for us to think of it as if we biodiversity living people are somehow the only people responsible here is wrong.
So for you, the key point there is that it's a people story. It's not necessarily just a nature.
It's first of all a people story.
Right.
I had the most harrowing 3-hour visit to the oil ministry in Ecuador a few years ago. I was there with my Huarani friends, and they were allowed into the oil ministry to argue for the Ecuadorian government not exploiting their property. And this junior minister sat for most of the 3 hours wagging her finger at these Warani Indians, saying, you stupid people, this is none of your business, this is our oil, it's nothing to do with you. It was the most appalling example of racism I've seen in my entire life. It was, we Highland Indians despise you Lowland Indians, and we don't give a damn if we kill you all. Now, that was a very emotional encounter for me, as you can probably gather, but it taught me that this isn't just about biodiversity. But you know, it's never just about biodiversity. If you look across the entire Amazon, the one thing that protects more of the Amazon than anything else are indigenous areas. And if you look at indigenous areas across the Amazon, they are not being deforested and they are not being burned. And they are effective, and they are effective when nations give rights to indigenous people. Thank you.
So a day ago, we had a panel here about sustainabilities in cities. And a lot of talk about how city life and sustainability in cities could benefit, you know, it was about sort of keeping cities green, keeping them clean, keeping them low carbon, and so on and so forth. But there was little linkage between city life and what's going on around it. So where does the water come from? Where does the air come from? Where does the food come from? And so on and so forth. Having an aquarium in a city, do you think it's, well, important to make that link back to nature, to biodiversity that's clearly outside? And it's an effective message. How do you guys do it?
I'm not sure I understand.
Okay, so when you live in a city, there's a lot of effort being made in cities to keep cities green and clean and low carbon. But there is still a big disconnect between city life and what goes on around the cities. Basically, most people in cities, for example, won't know where their water comes from. It might not be true here in this city. It's true in the city too. Right. So what can we do, or what do you do, to try to connect the people come to, for example, your aquarium, which are city dwellers, to the larger environment in which they're embedded and more often disconnected from?
So there's a few elements to your question here. The first is actually, how do we define nature? Because I think that we are moving to a definition of nature that is apart from a city, which I don't think is a very good definition of nature. Especially if you look at some of the urban ecology work, particularly in New York City with Central Park, nature is not distinct from city.
Right.
So I think that's the first very important educational step that needs to be made. We see more urban wildlife than we used to. Coyotes are moving into North Chattanooga. This is a huge deal for people. We're having more of these wildlife-human encounters than have happened in the past 20 years. So the first thing that we have to do is adjust our mind to make sure that we are not presenting a city as apart from nature, because I think that is definitely something we should not be doing. Chattanooga has done a lot of work to increase our green space, our parks. We have Crabtree Farm and Urban Farm that I believe a tour went to on Thursday. So there's a lot of ways in which we try to incorporate nature into the city and make sure that is obvious. But I think the other thing we have to do, and what we try to do at the aquarium, is present the watershed view to make sure that we understand whether we are in a city or whether we are on a farm, we are our watershed. That is our community. That is where we look to for our resources, for our neighbors, for our wildlife, is this watershed concept. So that's certainly where we swing our educational programs, looking both upstream at what's coming to us and then downstream for what our impact on our neighbors is.
Could I know I've sure. spent a lot of time talking, but I want to have a quick response to that. You can look for stories about what happens when it all goes pear-shaped. And one example is the town of Manizales in Colombia. It's a city about the same size as Chattanooga. A couple of years ago, the city lost its entire water supply for 2 weeks. So the mayor of the city said, "You all have to leave town." Can you imagine what would happen if that were Chattanooga? And the reason that they lost the water supply, it's in a mountainous area. It's a little bit more mountainous than here. But they had deforested the hillsides where the water supply came through pipes. There were landslides, and they lost the entire watershed. So these aren't, you know, hypothetical, you know, academic arguments about ecosystem services. They're very real. I should say that what Sanjan did not mention is, in addition to being a professor, I run a conservation organization. It's not surprisingly called Saving Species. It has Tom Lovejoy and Peter Raven and Ed Wilson and I are the science board members. And we focus on restoring degraded landscapes. And one of the landscapes that we are trying to help restore at the moment is the area around Manizales.
So in that case, that's a great example, right? So if you wanted to restore it, why couldn't you plant or restore those hillsides with a non-native fast-growing species? Why would it not be faster and just as useful, because you could get the service without still having the diversity that, you know, both of you spoke so eloquently about?
I think God would reach down and strike me dead. But be that as it may, the biodiversity itself is valuable because Colombia has more species of bird than any other country in the world, and so there is in fact an income stream from ecotourism. But the reality is, it really doesn't make a lot of difference to the cost whether we planted it in eucalyptus or native trees. So hell yes, we're going to use native trees and get the biodiversity income stream as well. But it will be morally reprehensible not to restore the original diversity.
Perhaps the journalists would view that as plagiarism, putting it in invasive species instead. You're just stealing from some other ecosystem. It's not your original work.
So invasive species is sort of interesting, right? So in some places we are increased. There's a paper that just came, or an essay that just came out in Nature magazine, I think 2 days ago, about how the Anthropocene is increasing diversity because of introduced species. In some cases where now the introduced species is no longer found in its original habitat, or is hybridized to a point where it can no longer breed back with the original. So you do have this challenge when we start getting involved in it. So, I should open this up because I know people are probably dying.
Yeah, sorry about that.
So let's just do that because we only have about 20 minutes. I can take a few questions as well, but I will generally try to... if you can keep it to a question, that'd be great, instead of a comment. Anyone? Wow. Yeah, sure. Go for it. And there are two microphones on either side.
My name is Harrison Treves. One question I had is... something I don't think I heard you mention, though maybe you were just referring to it in terms I didn't recognize, but what about the fact that when we fiddle with biodiversity, we may produce effects into the ecosystem that we can't even predict at the time, but could come back in a year or 5 years or 100 years and disturb it further? But kind of to reply to your comment about using a non-native species, what about the fact that the ecosystem is so complex, biodiversity may have benefits we don't even know about, but that could come back to bite us later?
Want to talk about kudzu?
Well, I mean, the obvious one is sort of, you know, the loss of vultures from the Indian subcontinent, you know, creates this mass epidemic of rabid dogs. And so you have the highest rate of rabies in the world in India because they lost, you know, 5 or 6 of their 9 species of vultures.
Absolutely. So the question was, is this an argument we should be making to the public, that we should maintain this simply because we don't know what the impacts are? And that would be the precautionary principle, which is sometimes appropriate in terms of we cannot foresee the impact of our actions, and so we should therefore do the action that has the least amount of potential harm to the environment because of that. Sometimes that is an effective argument. But sometimes if the economics outweigh that argument, it doesn't really hold a whole lot of weight.
Remember, TVA gave you kudzu. And the building is there somewhere. It's next door. You know, one wants to be very careful about doing these tinkerings.
Well, and this is going on right now with the hemlock woolly adelgid. We're now introducing beetles to eat the adelgid, and I cringe every time I hear that. You know, this is the cane toad in Australia. We've seen over and over that introducing a species to an environment can certainly have massive consequences beyond what we would have predicted at the time. But humans are really good at not learning from their mistakes.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Hi, David Steincross from Wisconsin. I'd like to pick up on a comment which you sort of made a minute ago. Talk a little bit, if you would, about evolutionary speed. And is it possible that organisms, especially the smaller ones, which reproduce more quickly, will hybridize, evolve to fill those niches that we are now so worried will go empty?
Species are going extinct about 1,000 times faster than their natural background rate. It's true that, you know, in time, evolution may claw some of that back, but you know, the overwhelming pattern is for the loss of biodiversity, not for the generation of new. It takes 1 million years to generate a new species. Don't hold your breath.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Sam Fromarts, and this is an agriculture-related question. Because crop breeders, especially commodity crop breeders, came under a lot of criticism going, as you know, back in the 70s and into the 90s for narrowing diversity within crops and threatening the food supply. More recently, they've taken genetics from wild cultivars, related cultivars, and bred those into, you know, their commodity crops. And they said they've essentially responded by saying, we've created more diversity, say, in cereals than was ever there before. And that, you know, and this is occurring at the same time that places where wild cereals are grown, you know, existed are, you know, basically disappearing. And I guess my question is can you manufacture biodiversity in that way? Is that biodiversity?
Well, this is where we struggle with a concept of biodiversity that's largely oriented at the species. When my training is actually as a geneticist, and I view genetic diversity is actually far more important in many ways than species-level diversity. These are the building blocks of how species adapt and respond to change. So the loss of genetic diversity is, frankly, terrifying to me. We need genetic diversity. We need it in humans. It's how our immune systems function and keep us able to respond to disease. So, you know, to actually get back to your question here, yes, you can create new genetic diversity, but that's being created with a very specific focus in mind as something that's useful to humanity to have a plant grow faster, to produce more food, to sustain the billions of people we have on this planet. It is not, to me, genetic diversity in terms of allowing that plant to be more able to survive random events that may happen in its future. So it's not exactly genetic diversity in terms of all of its random wonders that show up in the world. Do you want to add?
No. Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm Jim Bruggers with the Courier-Journal in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm just wondering if you all could assess the Endangered Species Act and how well it's working. And also, every now and then we hear about proposals to change it. I mean, are there things that you would do to make it more effective?
The Endangered Species Act is an extraordinarily successful piece of legislation. It has prevented a very, very large number of species going extinct. And some of that is obvious around us. We have peregrine falcons. There's probably some nesting in downtown Chattanooga. There are certainly, you know, I saw them regularly in Knoxville when I was a professor there. Bald eagles, our nation's bird, now nests in every state. Off the coast, we have a new whaling industry. We don't kill the whales, we photograph them. And it's generated an enormous amount of income. So there are unmistakable successes from the Endangered Species Act. There are cases where applying the Endangered Species Act would have prevented us from doing economically stupid things like building the you know, the Tellico Dam. Of course, there are people who are unhappy with the Endangered Species Act because it prevents them from becoming rich. So, yes, it's controversial. There are also tricky issues involving public land. And they are particularly difficult because the people who have endangered species on their land are usually the people who've looked after their land the best, and the sort of people with whom we would like to have, you know, a good working relationship. So there are areas there that require effort, but I'm on record as feeling that that requires not a new act, but you know, just good, you know, good stewardship and good sensible politics.
I mean, one of the challenges with, you know, so it is an extraordinarily useful piece of legislation. Although the whale thing was probably predating that with the Marine Mammal Protection Act as well.
I lump that in for convenience.
Sure. But the big challenge with it is really how Stuart started it off today, because it does pit this individual animal that gains this notoriety against society, against progress, against development, against jobs. And so if you're trying to build a broad coalition, if the environmental community wants to build a movement, as opposed to a niche, which is basically what it is. We have to figure out different ways of telling that story, because too often it comes down to a decision which is thus newsworthy, then it's, you know, then it's reported, but then it becomes wolves versus ranchers. And it isn't really about what the future of the Bitterroot Valley in Montana is really like. And so as Stuart, when he first started by saying, it's never about that individual animal going extinct. It really is symptomatic about something going on. The reverse is also true. The way the story is then described, even though the ESA is a very useful piece of legislation, it has polarized communities dramatically and made it very difficult to think bigger picture.
I would also add, I love the Endangered Species Act. It is only as good as the funding. So we have here in the Southeast a number of aquatic animals listed on the Act, and there's simply not enough funds being sent to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the Southeast to do any effective conservation for the animals that are on the Act. So, yes, they may be listed, but if they're not receiving resources to recover those species, it's not a very useful tool. It can harm us in some cases.
And funding often is linked to how useful that is. Like the Chinook salmon takes the largest chunk of ESA funding out there.
I think four salmon receive the majority of the funding under the Endangered Species Act. And so it's very frustrating to work in a diversity hotspot and not have the funding actually be correlated to the number of species that need to be protected under the Act. It's much more linked to economics.
Go ahead.
Thanks. Adam Glenn, CUNY, Graduate Journalism School. My question has to do with the rights of animals in relation to biodiversity, and going back to Anna's comment about intrinsic value and the kind of the moral argument. And we've been watching for years a very interesting legal argument develop about rights of animals, but there are some conflicts with biodiversity and species protection in general versus individuals, like individual chimps and research or dolphins, et cetera. But my question is there any value in that discussion, animal rights, in terms of raising awareness and moral discussion within a general public about biodiversity, or not? Is it a conflict?
There are some cases where you clearly see a split between animal rights advocates and environmentalists. The issue of cats and birds immediately comes to mind. What do we do with feral cats when they're hunting birds? There's issues in the fish world as well with very small darters no one's heard of. One endangered species was introduced to a spring in Alabama where another endangered darter lives, and now they're outcompeting this other darter species. What do we do with these individuals? If there's invasive species, is it appropriate to euthanize them, to remove them from the habitat so that a species can survive even at the expense of individuals? So these are all moral questions that come into play. I would say we don't have answers for a lot of them yet. It's a case-by-case situation, but it does require, again, that coalition, the diverse group of folks coming together to determine how best to protect this resource and trying to weigh these different values that individuals have. If you are a cat lover, you're never going to be happy watching feral cats removed from the environment, even as the environmentalists may be celebrating that.
And that's a pretty extreme example. I mean, even within the conservation community, say elephant conservation in Africa, should it take place through legalized trophy hunting and sale of legal ivory, or should it take place with a total ban on ivory and a total ban of hunting of elephants? Kenya thinks yes. Namibia says no. And you can really see the merits on both sides. Having seen elephants being killed in the field, it's not something really pleasant at all. So, you know, my gut immediately goes to one side of the camp. But just looking at the data, I can see the sides on both.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Heather Duncan, and I'm a reporter in Knoxville. And I have been an environment reporter in the Southeast for a long time, and I'm interested in what Anna and Stuart might think about the coverage that they see here, because I find I'm reminded at this conference of how different my audience is from most of these people's intended audience. The baseline is totally different here than it is in the Northeast or on the West Coast as far as what you can expect, the place where your audience is coming from and what their values are in relation to what you're writing about. And I wonder if we as journalists are not taking at times enough responsibility. And you've talked a lot about how advocates should pitch their position. And I mean, part of it is how we should be covering this and looking more broadly. And sometimes I feel like we have these silos that everybody that should care is going to be the rich, white, liberal urban person that basically doesn't live in my region. And I don't see people like people from Ducks Unlimited here, or people from, you know, there are very active conservation groups whose primary focus is on the use of that resource, but they accomplish a lot. And I wonder if we're missing some of that is really who our audience is here in the Southeast. And I'd just like some of your impressions on that.
I have a story for you. The opposition to the Tellico Dam was hatched inside Cherokee Country Club, which you know where it is, and I do. It was hatched by a group of people, one of whom had never met a Democrat until I married his daughter. And the fact is, Cherokee Country Club, which is full of, you know, country club Republicans, like my in-laws, were enormously angered by that dam. My father-in-law liked to fly fish in that river. And my understanding of the story is that they were totally unsuccessful in preventing that dam, and then decided that there was this professor who could be bribed by a couple of six packs of cheap beer. It was two, I believe, to go and find an endangered fish, and that's where David Ett and I went and found the fish. I think the wonderful thing about that story, other than the fact it's family, is that sometimes the opposition to these things does not come from where you think it is. And often the groups of people who come together to oppose something are not the simple lineup of people that you think they're going to be. There were people who opposed to that dam entirely because it was clearly an economically disastrous move.
So are we assuming an audience when we go out there and talk to them about...
But can I say one sentence more? What worries me about your profession is that I sometimes think that you are seduced into thinking that you know who the two sides are. And it's sometimes more complex than that. Thank you.
The one thing I would like to add, I know we're running out of time, is that Chattanooga is going through a visioning process right now in the 16-county region that surrounds it, Thrive 2055. And over, one of the things that has come up that people love most about this region is the mountains. That word is always used, and it always makes me smile, because it doesn't matter who you are, you understand beauty. You understand the environment. You understand the resource. And I discover that when I'm out in the field doing my work, that we may go say, yeah, we're looking for some minnows. And they're like, oh, that's great. There's some down there. Have fun. And then we bring up these bright red-bellied dace, and they're so excited to learn that this lives in their backyard. So I think that it's very important we keep in mind that humans do have an innate desire to connect with nature. Biophilia exists. We admire beauty. We admire the environment. We know we are part of it. So it's really important not to lose that message of hope and optimism, and to make sure that the environmental movement is not known for saying no to things, but instead for saying yes to things and protecting things and valuing and treasuring them, as opposed to being viewed as a stop to progress.
So we'll take one more quick question, and then that'll be it. Go for it.
Thanks. My name's Emily Guerin. I live in Western Colorado. And I was just wondering, you were talking earlier about the kind of problem with the Endangered Species Act being, you know, this endangered animal versus progress versus jobs, whatever. But what about when it's versus renewable energy? And when it's the desert tortoise versus industrial solar, or, you know, whatever bird versus wind turbines? Like, what do you think about that?
So what about trade-offs?
You know, I'm not trying to tell you that trade-offs don't exist. but I am asking you to look very carefully at whether they are as simple and as clearly defined as they are portrayed. I mean, the Tellico Dam snail data example has always been put into these two vehemently opposite camps, and it simply wasn't true. So look at these issues carefully. Is it really the harsh renewable energy versus species that the proponents want to make it? And ask, obviously, as part of your due diligence, who is saying that it is so rigidly separated? Is it more nuanced? Is it more complex? Are there other alliances in there that you need to explore?
And a quick
comment is that there's very seldom a reason where a single factor causes a species to go extinct. There's a whole web of interactions into play, and so this is a false dichotomy most times.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.